I scream, you scream, we all scream for ice cream. Oh, folks, this quintessential American food treat leads us to ask everyone, if you were to make ice cream, what would you add to it to make it more interesting?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, thank you, Will Strickland, and hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,113th edition of the Food Chain Radio Program, right here on the GCN Radio Network, or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way over there in Suva, who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Jason Struby. Jason?
It's a pleasure.
Now, if you were to make ice cream, have you ever made ice cream?
Never.
Never?
No.
If you were to make ice cream, what would you put in it to make it more interesting?
Dark chocolate shavings.
Okay. Chocolate. That's a popular consideration. Sarah Bell Lynn, what about you? Have you ever made ice cream?
I have. I've used the shaking bag method, which I'm sure many of you have tried before, and I've always enjoyed eating ice cream that way.
Well, what would you put in it to make it more interesting?
That's a very good question, Michael. I'd have to say I would put maybe ginger.
Ginger.
Yeah.
Ooh.
A little, you know, punch.
There you go. Well, folks, ice cream is the quintessential food treat, so much must have a good story to tell about ice cream in your past. Here's my favorite ice cream story, as told by Ernest Schnabel in Tales from a Tin Can by yours truly. The story takes place aboard the U.S. Navy destroyer Dale on the morning of 7 December 1941 in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Schnabel says, as we left our berth and got underway, the deck force was still engaged in getting ready for combat. One young bosun named Fuller had the job of clearing the deck of all the wooden objects that collected in port. And there was a lot of it, because in port we had all these awnings rigged to keep the tropical sun off the decks. You also had to get rid of all the wooden swabs and buckets and boxes, because if a machine gun bullet from a Japanese airplane were to strike any of it, slivers would fly all over the place just like shrapnel. So Fuller was making his way aft, just tossing stuff like a madman, when he came to the wooden ice cream gedunk. He was grabbed it and started to push it over the side, when one of the guys said, "Hey, wait a minute." Back in 1941, ice cream was a mighty precious commodity in the destroyer Navy. Today you can find ice cream and sugar candy on almost any street corner, but back then we tin can sailors had to get our ice cream off the bigger ships that had the equipment to make it, and they almost always figured out a way to make us pay for it, too. So, when that young bosun struck a nerve when he made moves to toss all the ship's ice cream over the side, in a matter of seconds, the lock was broke and the ice cream distributed among the crew. Then Fuller kicked the empty wooden gedunk over the side. So what you saw that morning, back there on December 7, 1941, was the USS Dale steaming hellbent out into the channel, while the guys back aft were standing by their guns, eating ice cream, and watching World War II break out all around them. Well, as Schnabel remarked, today you can find ice cream on just about anywhere. Because it has become so ubiquitous, we've kind of lost our attraction to it, the kind of attraction we once had way back when. But a new breed of ice creamery is emerging from the industrial wasteland to bring us new flavors, tastes, and textures that just might rekindle a love we once had for that quintessential American food treat. And so today we challenge one and all. If you were to make ice cream, what would you add to make it more interesting? And who better to challenge that than Amy Ettinger, who is the author of Sweet Spot, an ice cream binge across America. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you aboard. Now, I'm so jealous. You came up with the first book ever on ice cream.
Yes, it's the first narrative nonfiction book about ice cream. There's some histories out there, but mm-hmm. I went out there and I melded my memories. I have a lot of ice cream memories, my childhood memories, with interviews that I did all around the country.
Kind of gonzo journalism, right?
I did, yeah. I got to eat a lot of ice cream, but I did a lot of reporting. I talked to the people who are making it about how they're making it and why they're making it.
And?
They are working incredibly long hours doing it. Mm-hmm. But
it's really a craft, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a craft and an art and also a labor of love. I went out to Milwaukee and I talked to the custard makers out there. They have several generations of custard makers in Milwaukee that, you know, the recipes and the way they do it have been passed down from generation to generation. They're working 14 or 15-hour days. Some of these folks haven't taken a vacation in, you know, 7 years.
Why don't we have frozen custard in the rest of the world?
So they have special equipment in certain places in the United States. Milwaukee is...
Let me guess. They probably have, right on top of the ice cream maker, they have a cage full of chickens.
They have these 1940s or 1950s huge machines that they used to call the iron lungs that press out all the air or most of the air in the custard, and it creates this delicious, dense, very regional treat that you can't really find in other parts of the country. I mean, sometimes in St. Louis they have some famous custard, but to get really, you know, traditional frozen custard, you have to travel, and there are not that many kinds of food right now in the United States that you have to travel to really enjoy.
Right.
Frozen custard is one of them.
So, next time in Milwaukee.
Yes.
Huh. I missed out last time in Milwaukee, but next time I'm not going to. If that's where I have to go to get frozen custard.
Yes, you can try a couple of different places and tell me what you think is your favorite. I have my favorite, but they're all pretty fantastic.
Okay, so it's this equipment that limits the availability on that, then.
Yeah, but you know, if you talk to the frozen custard makers, everybody's got their theory. So what? Some folks say it's the equipment, and some folks say, well, you know, we've got the Wisconsin cows, and we've got the Wisconsin eggs, and mm-hmm. that's what really makes the difference. Custard has more egg than traditional ice cream. It's kind of what I like to call a delicious cousin of ice cream. You know, it's not quite the same.
You know, you're really getting to something here. Wisconsin has cows.
Yes.
But Wisconsin has something else that makes the cows work. California has cows. But there's a huge difference in what those cows eat in California and what they eat in Wisconsin.
And that's what the folks who make the custard, who I talk to in Wisconsin, say. Our cows are eating different food.
They're eating grass.
They're eating grass, and they have more room, you know, and the milk that comes out of these cows and the cream, it tastes different. They swear by it.
Oh, now I'm really hungry. Now I'm really hungry for custard. Of course, California cows are pretty much in feedlots eating grain.
Yes. There are some organic, you know, where they get to...
Well, there's still... you can be organic and still have them eat grain. But, you know, cows on grass. And, well, okay. Now, you talked with somebody else that is currently in the news, probably not wanting to be in the news, but they are in the news, and that's Ben and Jerry.
Yeah. I talked to Jerry from Ben and Jerry's about the start of his company and mm-hmm. how some of these flavors got started as well. And so that was a really interesting interview. That was one of my most fun interviews for this book because I grew up on Ben and Jerry's. I just grew up eating pints of it and loving it and, you know, really digging in after my first heartbreak and my second heartbreak.
There you go. Always works, right?
Yes.
Eat your way out of that one. And, of course, Ben and Jerry's is in the news right now because the Organic Consumers Association has found that 10 of 11 samples of Ben and Jerry's ice cream contain glyphosate, the weed killer glyphosate. Wow. So that's a significant find, and that kind of goes far beyond the vision of the Ben and Jerry that I thought I knew.
Yeah, well, Ben and Jerry's was sold a while back to Unilever, so they're owned by a large corporation, and one of the interesting conversations I had with Jerry was that when they sold, they really lost the influence that they had on the brand. It still has their name. It still has their faces on the packaging, but they don't get a say in the company.
And now it has glyphosate in the ice cream.
So there really is, it's an interesting story, and it has been since the sale, of what happens to a brand when it gets bought by a larger company.
Do I sense a book coming out?
There have been some interesting books on Ben & Jerry's already. Mm-hmm.
But I mean about the interesting book about what happens when you sell your brand.
Yeah.
That would be a fun follow-up research. Probably not as fun as ice cream, but interesting subject. So Ben & Jerry sold their ice cream brand.
And many places have, too. I mean, I talked to these two women who run the Cool House brand down in Los Angeles, and they really want to be bought out by Unilever. Like, that's their dream. And then I talked... Okay. And then I talked to, you know, artisanal ice cream makers in New York who have sold their brand and missed having it, and so they started another company.
Well, let's toss this out to the audience. Will you be boycotting Ben & Jerry's because it has glyphosate, or will you keep eating it?
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. Ah, you can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it. Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it. Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it. Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it. Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy. You can do it. Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy. You can do it. Metro Farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we are back, but we were just having a raging discussion about Ben & Jerry's and whether we should or should not boycott them. The Organic Consumers Association claims that it found glyphosate, the weed killer glyphosate, in 10 of 11 samples of Ben & Jerry's ice cream. The only thing that did not have glyphosate in it was Cherry Garcia. Right, that was the only one. Everything else had glyphosate in it. So the Organic Consumers Association say we should boycott until such time as Ben & Jerry's starts feeding its cows organic grains. But it's not Ben & Jerry anymore. It's Unilever. Unilever owns Ben & Jerry, and poor Ben & Jerry are like captured on the cover of each Ben & Jerry's ice cream thing. So I don't know. Let's take a sample. Jason Struby, will you be eating Ben & Jerry's ice cream?
Probably not anytime real soon, no.
Sarah Bell?
You know, I can't say that I will. I mean, with Chipotle, I was eating that by the week, and then when I found out that they've discovered E. coli in it, I just completely dropped it out of my life. So
there. You're worse than I am. Well, Amy?
You know, I make my own ice cream. So okay. Whenever I can, I eat that, and I'm blessed to live by some delicious ice creamery. But I don't think I would pass it up if somebody were offering
somebody
it to me.
Okay.
But I am an ice cream obsessive. I do love ice cream, so it's hard for me to pass it up.
Hard to say no on
cream.
That one. Well, what do you think out there? Will you be boycotting Ben & Jerry's? We're at 831-479-1080. And furthermore, you can ask any question you want about ice cream, because we have the ice cream gal here, author of Sweet Spot, Amy Ettinger, who wrote the first book I think I've ever read about ice cream. And it's a truly amazing that there have been no books written about ice cream. And you discovered that. When did you discover that?
You know, I was eating, when I was pregnant with my daughter, I was eating a tremendous amount of ice cream. I mean, I've always eaten ice cream, but this just, it was off the charts. And
well, how do you do that without gaining a lot of weight?
Well, I was pregnant, so I was gaining weight. But, you know, now I eat a lot of it because it's my really my one vice, my one okay. treat. And then I exercise to kind of compensate. So, yeah, I was noticing all the artisanal shops that were opening up all over the country. And I thought, oh, somebody must have written about this before. I mean, there's so many new mom-and-pop shops, but nobody had. And I said, well, I'm going to do this, and I better do it fast before somebody beats me to it.
And you did it, and you got it. Well, take us back, Amy, because take us back to our founding fathers. One of the interesting things about your book was the story of George Washington and ice cream.
We all know that George Washington had a sweet tooth, and the story usually is cherry pie.
That was before he had the wooden teeth.
Yes. Okay. But really what he loved was ice cream. He loved, you know, food in general. He was a foodie.
Yeah, he was a foodie.
But ice cream, when he was introduced to it around in the 1770s, it just took hold, and Martha loved it too. They bought a 306-piece ice cream making serving kit that they found at his estate at Mount Vernon. He had a special ice houses built at Mount Vernon, and he had a really hard time having those built. They were crumbling, and he would write to his, you know, friends, help me, I can't figure out the architecture of these ice houses. But that's a real key component in if you're a foodie and you want ice cream, is there's no electrical refrigeration. You need ice. You need to be able to keep
it. So ice cream
cold.
Became the food of the elite, right?
It did. It really did. And then Thomas Jefferson, he had a whole stint in France, and he was introduced to ice cream. He came back and he recorded America's first ice cream recipe, which was vanilla. So, but eventually it moved from the elite to the popular, and ice cream started being served at 4th of July parties all over the country. And then, of course, in soda fountains, and when the ice cream cone hit the scene, the ice cream cone was invented at the St. Louis World's Fair in 1904. It became a very cheap ice cream delivery, you know, system.
Yeah, amen. You know? Ice cream cones.
If you think about it, you know, in the ice cream parlors used to have to spend a lot of time and a lot of money washing those glass cups and those spoons. But you make an ice cream cone, and your customers can just hit the street, and there's no messy cleanup. Mm-hmm. And it really became a very popular treat after that.
And one of the interesting stories you bring up is the story of Dr. Benjamin Rush.
Oh, the soda fountains?
Yeah, the soda fountains.
Yeah, the soda fountains are a really interesting history in the United States. I always thought of the soda fountains as, you know, you think of the soda jerks and this kind of fun time. Like, I always associate it with the 1950s, but really it goes back to the 19th century. And people were putting some very interesting things in their soda drinks.
Whatever they could get away with.
Exactly.
Which was everything back then, right?
Because the soda fountains were part of the pharmacies. Most of the medicines were not coming out in pills. They were coming out in little tinctures. And those tinctures tasted terribly. They were bitter. They were horrible. So, you know, the expression, a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. They would put the tinctures in the soda fountain drinks. And some of these tinctures were very bad for you. I mean, some of them were just illicit, you know, they were morphine and
cocaine.
Yeah, cocaine was a biggie. But some of them were poisonous, and there were arsenic and strychnine, but they thought they were remedies.
It'll cure whatever ails you,
yeah.
For sure, right?
It'll take care of everything.
Yeah.
So the history of the soda fountain in this country was fascinating to research.
And part of that, of course, is ice cream. They became one of the delivery systems for ice cream.
Exactly. Yeah.
And as we move along, ice cream, the manufacturing of ice cream was started with, you have to have local dairies, right?
Yeah.
But as the dairy industry started consolidating, so too did the ice cream industry, right?
Yeah, you know, a lot of the brands in this country are really owned by Unilever and Nestle at this point. And so that's what makes this new influx of artisanal and mom and pop shops so interesting to me, because they are getting their dairy. I mean, usually it's prepackaged mixes or bases, but they're making them in their own stores, and they're flavoring them in their own stores. And so it's sort of a push against, I think, this big corporation, some of the big corporations that own so many of the brands.
And I guess a great example of that was Ben & Jerry's.
Yes, definitely. They were, in many ways, the first.
I mean, they started in the garage, right?
They did. They were the hippies in the garage in Vermont, and they were using, you know, the Vermont cows and the Vermont flavorings, and they really...
Again, it sounds like cows that eat grass.
Uh-huh.
Ice cream.
They really started a trend that we're seeing really this boom of right now.
And what was it that did different, Ben & Jerry's? I mean, probably, you know, the most exotic ice cream of the time was Neapolitan, right?
Yeah, you know, they were raised on, you know, the Breyers. What a lot of folks from that generation that grew up in the 50s and the 60s, they were eating Breyers, or out here, Dreyer's ice cream. And that's a lot of chocolate, strawberry, vanilla, maybe coffee. I mean, when Häagen-Dazs came out in the scene in the 60s, then their real contribution to strange flavors was coffee. But in the 70s and 80s, you had Steve Harrell from the Boston area, who started doing these smooshins, or these add-ins. And Ben & Jerry's had that Steve Harrell's, and they said, we want to do that too, and we want to go even wackier and see what else we can get away with putting in our ice cream. And that's when you get the cookie dough and the pretzels and everything else.
I bet they were smoking pot and got the munchies and tried to think, oh, let's go out to fun here. Well, folks, we are having fun. We are talking about ice cream, and it is summer. It is ice cream season. We have Amy Ettinger with us. She's the author of Sweet Spot, an ice cream binge across America. That sounds like too much fun. It should almost be illegal. But I bet you've had fun with ice cream, have you not? Pick up your phone and join us with your favorite ice cream story. Love to hear it. We're at 831-479-1080, 831-479-1080. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, the whole crew, and you, 831-479-1080.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we were eating ice cream, or we wish we were eating. Amy, you didn't bring any ice cream. You know, I'm just so sad. We are talking with Amy Ettinger, the author of Sweet Spot, Ice Cream Binge Across America. And we've got phone callers calling in at 831-479-1080. Really quickly, I'd like to go back to Ben & Jerry's and how these two hippies in a garage blossomed into this incredible... What did they do that so entranced America?
They really showed us that you can put almost anything in ice cream.
You can have fun with ice cream.
Yeah. You know, I have always loved cookie dough ice cream. So I asked Jerry, I said, how did cookie dough ice cream come about? Because, you know, how does that happen? And he said, well, it was really slow in the winter in Vermont. And so we were selling cookies to try to, you know, boost sales. And one day the guy who was making the cookies was standing next to the guy who was making the ice cream. And they said, well, what's going to happen if we just combine these two things? And they really took that creativity and that happenstance and that inventiveness, and they just went with it.
I think they were smoking pot. I know they were. It had to be what they were doing. And so the world woke up to, oh, my goodness, ice cream can be delicious. It can be different. It can be fun. And boom. Their business went to the moon.
Yeah, and they really got the idea of distribution. You know, if you want to make it in this country, and that's always been the case, if you want to make a name for yourself, you have to distribute, and you have to figure out a way to do that. So they distributed, and they really got their name and their brand out there.
And it went so far out there that the Unilever Corporation bought it.
They bought them, yes.
And now Ben & Jerry's is held captive on the cover of Ben & Jerry ice cream. And inside 10 of 11 Ben & Jerry's ice cream, there's glyphosate. And so that's the story of the industrialization of our food chain. And all of a sudden, now, we have alternatives.
We do.
And are they all of these craft ice creameries doing the same thing Ben and Jerry did?
No, I think they're doing some different things for sure. I think that they're not putting so many candy inclusions. I mean, that's what a lot of what Ben and Jerry's did is a lot of candies and cookies. And I think that the folks that I talked to, I mean, there's a guy in Petaluma in California who has decided to milk water buffalo and make gelato out of it, and is keeping his flavors very, very simple. It's kind of the opposite of Ben and Jerry's in many ways. It's how can we taste the flavor of the water buffalo milk, which is very different from cow's milk. So there's a simplicity among a lot of these artisanal ice cream makers that I find really interesting.
Well, Sarah Bell Lynn, you work for an artisanal ice creamery.
That's right.
And what do you put? What do they put into their ice cream?
Well, I know that Penny Ice Creamery uses eggs. It's a pre-base. There's milk. There's sugar. Let's see. There's eggs, milk, sugar,
and cream,
and cream.
But what flavorings?
Well, at my location at Pleasure Point, we tend to cater to the crowd. We have a lot of crowd pleasers.
So you really make it for the neighborhood almost, right?
Pretty much, yeah. We only really switch out a few of the flavors from week to week, but we do carry a lot of crowd pleasers, such as vanilla, Tahitian vanilla. We'll always have a couple sorbets rotating. We'll always have bitter caramel and Verve coffee, which are two of my favorites.
Okay. So put whatever you want into it. And then there is the whole world of making it yourself, which leads us to our first phone call today at 831-479-1080. We have Norman on the line who has a question or a comment about a family ice cream recipe. Norman, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you very much. What I'm going to give you is a recipe that's been in our family for well over 120 years.
Everybody's taking out their pens and pencils, Norman. Okay, go ahead.
And anyway, here's the recipe, and this never fails if you do it right. First, you want 4 eggs, well beaten, 2.5 cups sugar, 2 cans of Eagle brand or condensed milk, either one, 1 pint heavy whipping cream, 7 cups whole milk, 1/4 teaspoon of salt, 2 or 3 tablespoons of vanilla extract, a dash of fresh lemon juice, and of course, this is all going to go into a genuine old-time hand crank White Mountain freezer. And you start turning it and turning it, adding salt, adding
salt to the ice.
Yeah, salt to the ice to make the ice melt, because it's ice is colder when it melts. And you just crank it until you can barely do it.
That's right.
It just sets up really stiff.
Now, let me ask wait a minute, Norman. Yeah. Let me ask you the real significant question here. Is the ice cream better in a hand crank or an electric crank? Amy here is lazy, and she uses an electric crank.
We've tried it both ways, and really it's just a matter of convenience.
I know.
In other words, there's no, you can't use that because, you know, there's none of that around.
Okay.
And this is a real old-time recipe that Norman has been, since I was a little kid, before that, the grandkids. And
well, Norman, let me ask you this, because I was telling Amy that I remember being a little tyke and growing up on the grandparents' farm and watching the milk come out of the cow into a separator and then into the ice cream crank. Little ice cream machine. So we were eating a whole fresh raw milk ice cream, probably for the best part of my early years. Did you do the same, or was it pasteurized?
Oh, it was pasteurized by then.
Okay.
By then meaning in the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And he, well before that, too.
Okay, fair enough.
And I just wanted to make sure you were talking about ice cream the way I know it. And
there could be no better way of knowing it, could there, Norman?
Pardon me now?
There could be no better way of knowing it than with Norman's hand crank ice cream maker.
You bet. The old White Mountain freezer.
Thank you very much. Amy's been looking for one of those. Where can she find one?
Just start looking at the local flea markets and the local antique stores. And
there you go.
You'll find them somewhere, and they won't know what they're doing with it. But anyway.
All right. I'll keep my eyes out.
Yes, please do.
Thank you very much for the call. We got to take a quick break here in just a minute. But when we come back, I'd like to talk with Amy, because you make your own ice cream all the time.
I do, yes.
How long does it take?
It really takes 2 days.
2 days?
Yeah, because you got to make it ahead of time and let it sit in the refrigerator. That is the step that most people don't do, is making the base ahead of time and letting it sit.
Yeah, I've never been able to let it sit.
Really?
No. Are you kidding?
And then you got to you put it through the electric. I would do a hand cranked if I could. And then if you let it harden in the freezer, it's even better.
Even better. Okay, folks, we're talking ice cream with you. 831-479-1080 is the phone number. Pick up your phone. Any question you have about ice cream, we have the expert, Amy Ettinger, author of Sweet Spot, an ice cream binge across America. I haven't even got there yet.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson and Amy Ettinger, author of Sweet Spot and Ice Cream Binge Across America. But wait, we haven't even got to the Ice Cream Binge Across America. Take us, please, Amy.
Well, I started the binge in Santa Cruz, California. And
West Coast.
Yes. And the entire Bay Area. And when I'd sort of exhausted the opportunities there, mm-hmm. I went out to Milwaukee, as I mentioned, and I tried the frozen custard
there.
And
we were talking about custard there.
Yeah. And I also went to New York, and I tried the artisanal ice cream shops there. And I also went on the back of an ice cream truck. It was a dream of mine, because I never had the ice cream truck come down my street when I was a kid in Silicon Valley. No,
it ding, 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 ding,
never came, and I was desperate to find it. And so I went out, and I went on the back of a truck. This woman is, she took over her dad's route. He was a good humor man in the 1940s, and she's getting into turf wars with Mr. Softy guys who are coming on her route. So I talked to her, and then I went...
How did she deal with that?
She has been arrested. She's gotten into fist fights with them. She has vandalized their trucks. They vandalized her trucks. It seems like it's calmed down a little bit, but she's selling the prepackaged stuff out of her
mm-hmm.
truck.
And they're selling...
They're selling soft serve. Mr. Softy soft serve, and that is more appealing right now to that neighborhood than her ice cream treats. So it's hard. It's a changing time. You know, it's not just the good humor days in some ways are kind of over. Our taste buds have changed, and people don't necessarily want the prepackaged.
You know, it's true all throughout the food chain, really.
Yeah.
Look what's happening to Kellogg's and, mm-hmm. you know, so on. Big changes.
Yeah. So it's interesting. And you know, to see what's happening in Manhattan, it's like, you know, San Francisco with these artisanal shops just on every street corner.
Beer and ice cream.
Yes.
We've got it down, right? Who needs anything else?
Exactly.
Beer and ice cream, we're there.
And then I also headed up to Seattle, and I talked to an ice cream maker up there who has his own cows off of Jersey cows, which are different from the Holsteins, on Vashon Island, which is right out of Seattle. And he flavors all of his ice creams. He pasteurizes on Vashon Island, brings the prepackaged, you know, the pre-pasteurized mix to a shop in Seattle, and all the flavorings, for the most part, are from his farm.
Wow.
So it's this real, I got a real sense of what ice cream makers are doing across the country.
So it seems like, one of my theories is that all industries heading in one of two directions, very, very big, very, very small.
Mm-hmm.
Everything in the middle is kind of like roadkill.
You know, it was interesting because Jerry did talk about, Jerry from Ben & Jerry's, the difference of, you know, having a shop that really gets big and how you can't be as risk-taking once you're distributing all across America. You can't, because if it's a flavor that's a bust, that's big money.
That's a big bust, yeah.
But you can take risks in smaller places because you're making, I don't know, 10 gallons or 20 gallons, and if it's a bust, you just don't ever serve it again. So that's really interesting for chefs who really want to push the envelope. You got to do it in a small place, I think.
Well, Sarah Bell, you work in an ice cream shop. Have you ever served a bust? Something that just didn't work?
Well, before I answer that question, I would actually like to fine-tune something that I answered earlier. I said that Penny Ice Creamery's pasteurization process included a pre-made base, and that's not true. Everything is made at the Cedar location.
Okay.
So I wanted to just make that clear. Now, to answer your question, no, I have not.
There you go. All right, fair enough. There we go. So, Milwaukee, you know, sometimes this story about writing the story or doing the story is as interesting about the subject of the story. And what you discovered about Milwaukee was not only the fact that they have custard, but they have crime.
They do. And I knew that going out there. But I didn't realize it was going to impact me personally. You know, I was in Milwaukee to research this book. I needed to go there because they're the custard capital of the world. And I was carjacked in broad daylight in a very affluent part of town. But then, you know, these Good Samaritans kind of took me under their wings and they helped me out. They found my wallet, they found my phone, and they, you know, sent the wallet back to me. So I got to see a really interesting slice of Milwaukee. It wasn't just the crime. Mm-hmm. I also kind of saw the salt of the earth folks, which mm-hmm. I really think about when I think about the Midwest, really hard workers who take care of each other. I got to see both parts of that city, and it's kind of rare as a reporter when you just kind of drop into a place and you get to see just such a broad view. It was shocking. And fortunately, I was not injured. I was alone. I wasn't with my daughter or my husband at the time. So
you were fighting.
I was.
You were fighting for your car, your purse.
I really was. And I write about in the book, you know, I am the youngest. I'm the baby, and I have two older brothers. So I kind of learned how to fight with them.
I read that part, and my sister still won't talk to me after all these years. That said, well, we've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, Sarah Bell has a good question for you, and that, of course, is kind of a good way of summing up your experiences as you have gone on a ice cream binge across America. What fun. I mean, I'm so jealous. It's to exceed America in its ice cream, which is truly one of our great American traditions, right?
Yeah.
And Amy Ettinger, Sweet Spot, an ice cream binge across America. So get yourself a big, huge, giant tub of ice cream and a copy of Sweet Spot and kick back and enjoy it. We will be right back with some final thoughts from Amy Ettinger and you, 831-479-1080.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends to do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is two numbers. One is two, the other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy, it'll make you blush. Pledge two local bucks each day. Get two others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at metrofarm.com.
2x2.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Okay, we do have a few minutes left, and Sarah Bell has a good summation question. So what was it, though? You didn't tell me. What is it?
Amy, I would love to ask you, what is the most valuable insight that you've gained after you've gone on this amazing ice cream adventure?
Well, it was really interesting, because I write that I have become in some ways more of an ice cream snob. Like, the more ice cream you eat, the more picky in particular you become. Now I know more about how it's made. So I have become a bit of an ice cream snob, but I also am open more to those wonderful memories that you get transported to when you have ice cream, whether it is this wonderful quality or some of the industrial stuff that is served to you. That it is the experience and the memories of ice cream that are really what makes it such a special treat for us all.
Kind of like the watermelon you remember eating as a kid with a bunch of other kids on a hot summer day, and how the watermelon just kind of drools down your chest and the seeds everywhere, and oh yes,
exactly.
I
think we're all kind of chasing those memories, and with ice cream I'm definitely chasing that, and sometimes it's these very like high quality artisanal ice creams that bring me back there, but often it's not, and so I've become a little bit more open to that.
Now, when you were raising your daughter, mm-hmm. were you cognizant of the importance of those early memories? I mean, this is the mother question, right? And you know, as growing up and going through this great tour of America via ice cream, and you're realizing it's all tied back to memories.
Yeah, and she's come with me on so many of these journeys, and so it is her experience of ice cream eating is going to be very interesting when she looks back. She came on the book tour with me, and she did a lot of the research. She was on the back of that ice cream truck mm-hmm. with me in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. So it is interesting to think we're creating those memories as I'm trying to relive some of my childhood. Mm-hmm. Memories.
And you think then, wow, she's going to take these memories with her then too.
Exactly. And what will she do with them?
Mm-hmm. Wow. What about you, Sarah Bell? Do you have those memories?
Oh, yes. I could not stop thinking about all the creamsicles that I ran after when I was spending my summers in Stockton back in the day. Mm-hmm. There were ice cream trucks every single day, and there was nothing that could bring me out of bed in the morning like an ice cream truck could.
Ding, 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 ding,
I'm
ding,
so
ding.
I'm so jealous you got to hear them. We never had them.
Well, I grew up in the Silicon Valley as well, so it took me escaping from the Cupertino area and traveling somewhere after it.
Yeah, I can certainly remember them from my youth. And you know what? When I see them still, you know, I hear the little tinkle, tinkle, mm-hmm. tinkle, like, oh, pleasure.
Yeah, it's amazing how
Pavlov must have something
exactly.
to say about that.
Exactly. Taste and also sound just play such an important role in our memories. And that was the other just amazing thing that I realized while I was doing the research on this book.
Well, there it is, folks. Sweet Spot, an ice cream binge across America. Amy Ettinger, so buy yourself a big tub of ice cream, your favorite thing to put in it, or on it, or with it, and pick up this copy of this book and sit out in the backyard, which is where my book is, waiting for me, and have some fun. Until then, remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, which is cheap food isn't. And thank you for tuning in. See you next week for more What's Eating What on the Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.